Hi, Tom Papinski. Welcome to KABU.
Thank you.
Tom Papinski teaches politics at Cornell. He writes a great deal. His specialty is the rise of authoritarianism, which he first studied in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, Thailand, the Philippines, and then he generalized to examine it across the globe. So, Tom, your choice to study authoritarianism turned out to be very prescient. When you started, establishment political science still accepted the idea that, and pretty much all of social science somehow were gulled into thinking that history has ended, that democratic capitalism has triumphed. Because it was so productive, it spread the wealth and comfort to the whole population, surely not equally, but still vastly improved the lives of the great majority. And that every country would somehow be pressed that would have to adopt democratic capitalism in order to attract investment and maintain popular support. Today, though, history has not just ended, it's really returned in a very menacing way, because we surely see capitalism solidifying its already dominant power across the globe, but not bringing democratic gains. In fact, the opposite. What we see today is the global rise of authoritarian movements and parties, like in Europe, that have only won a few elections but are menacing in almost every country. So, Tom, what happened to the end of history, to the triumph of democratic capitalism, and why did it happen?
Well, you're only asking the single most important question of our time, and I won't pretend to have a definitive or singular answer to it, but I can give you some thoughts that I think might be interesting to reflect upon. The first thing I'd say is it's actually been about the past 15 years that political scientists have been asking this question about whether or not we should accept the finality of democratic government as the final state to which all countries are developing. Now, we had known for a long time that you can just look across time at any index of democracy or freedom or civil liberties that you'd want to find, and there's a steady increase over time. And that's true, but it masks a whole lot of difference, a whole lot of variation. And starting around the early 2000s, political scientists started to say, well, what is this thing, what is this type of regime that has elections, and maybe it even has more than one party, but it's not getting any more liberal, it's not getting any more free, it's not getting any more competitive. And starting, as I said, about 15 years ago, people started using a term called competitive authoritarianism, which is a term that reflects a particular type of political system in which elections do exist, they're regularly held, and they're not even necessarily uncompetitive. But the structure of political competition is so unevenly tilted towards the incumbent government, towards the regime, that competition and regime change is really impossible. And so starting around, like I said, the 2000s, you had people studying countries like Malaysia, you had people studying countries like Russia under Putin, you had people studying countries like Venezuela, people studying countries like Mexico prior to the democratization in the late 1990s. And we developed actually a fairly sophisticated understanding of these types of regimes. But what was really surprising is that nobody really thought that could possibly apply to the United States. Nobody had really thought that these were types of regimes that would emerge out of what are otherwise quite competitive democratic regimes. Rather, they had been seen as kind of a stalled or incomplete transition that had become stable and solidified. So we have the tools, but now we need to be looking in different places for how to apply them.
In fact, now in the United States, you see that same pattern in its sort of infancy, and that is the effort to, not an attack on electoralism, but a effort to take control of the electoral process, like voter suppression and all of those things seem to be early. But Trump is also dangerous in other ways, it seems to me.
I think that's right. I think you've diagnosed first one mechanism that is commonly found across the world. When you wish to tilt elections in favor of the incumbent regime, you do everything that you can to ensure that you control who votes. That's not new in the United States. We have to remember that. That's been a history that's been long part of how American politics works. But I think that the presumption that the president led with during the campaign, that if he lost, that would itself be evidence that something had gone wrong, that there was an improper type of voting, is novel and dangerous.
Yeah, tell us why.
Well, because what that means is that it's impossible to demonstrate that the election has been conducted fairly if the evidence that you use is the outcome. Rather, he's not very interested. He wasn't very interested in naming or investigating specific examples, because had he done so, the evidence suggests that there's not a lot of, say, electoral fraud or immigrants voting or what have you. Rather, the tone was that the election itself could only be valid if the outcome was what he had anticipated.
Yeah. Many of the dictators then who annul an election that way, and the military supports them, and that's basically the end of even any possibilities of the democratic experiment.
I think that's right. You know, it's interesting, though, the thing to remember is it doesn't have to be the military who does this. It often is, it sometimes can be. But if the people themselves, if a substantial number of people are unwilling to respect the outcome of an election because they don't like it, or they tend to give credence to one side over the other as having greater authority to define what legitimacy is, then the military can stay in the barracks and the outcome can be the same.
Well, sometimes they also do it through the courts, right? You pack the courts. And in fact, we saw an early evidence of that sort of mild. The Supreme Court basically decided to end the election, the Bush-Gore election, and declare Bush the president based on the fear of disorder if the American people thought that the uncertainty of the election would drive them to some kind of psychic breakdown. It was all preposterous. It had nothing to do with the law. The law that they used was, I'm an old lawyer, was never used in that way. In fact, it's been limited in every conceivable way. Suddenly they dragged out this idea and just seated Bush. When they got away with that, it seems to me that that strengthened the whole process of de-democratization.
Well, what's interesting about that is that that had the effect on you and me that Trump's rhetoric prior to the election had on many of his supporters, which is that it leads us to believe that the institutions and procedures of democratic governance cannot be trusted in and of themselves. This is a symmetrical argument. If either side, if you imagine politics as, to simplify, a struggle between a left and a right, or a populist and an elite, or whatever have you, if either side, it doesn't require just one, if either side loses faith in the process, then there's no reason to ask for that process or to vest in that process the authority to allocate political power. And that's all democracy is a procedure to allocate political power. It's a procedure that has, for me, some nice properties, some things that I think are valuable, but it's not a panacea. So if people think they'd rather fight over substantive politics than trust in the procedures, then the trust in the system is undermined. And it's hard to imagine going back.
Yeah, on the other hand, you could make that argument about almost any abuse of power within the state. It's all used by the authoritarians to say government can't be trusted. On the other hand, if some of the agencies, like a lot of the agencies of the Interior Department, are in fact making decisions, or the Agriculture Department, that are racist towards Native Americans or blacks, or giving great benefits to, let's say, the oil companies, which they've done over the years, and especially towards Native American oil revenues, it seems to me that one has to challenge those things and not sort of argue, well, government requires faith in government, and therefore we don't want these scandals to be ended.
I agree with you, but this is a dilemma that we face, and there's no easy or simple answer to how do you decide what is too much of a violation of a norm or principle to be acceptable. But it's clear to me that progressives make a choice about what are the hills upon which they're willing to die, and what are the hills upon which they're willing to say we lost this election, and we lost this policy battle, and we're going to return and follow the procedures that we wish to follow in order to win in the next one. Remember, the mid-2000s were a time of catastrophic thinking for progressives, just catastrophic thinking for progressives. And that lack of faith or trust in American institutions, the most consequential thing that could have happened to restore that faith was just the victory of their own candidate in 2008. And so that's the terms upon which I think progressives need to be thinking.
This is KABU Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Tom Pepinski, who studies authoritarianism. We've been discussing the roots of it and the many dilemmas of maintaining democratic government. Let's talk about, Tom, now another dilemma of democratic government that it seems to me is also goes very, very deep, which is the disenfranchisement of most people in politics because of a variety of factors, one of which is in daily life, the issues have become so complex and people spend so little time in actually democratic structures, and particularly at work, which are extremely authoritarian, and in fact the work has been de-skilled, so it becomes more authoritarian, and then unions are being destroyed, which means there's even less democratic participation in thinking about work. It seems to me we're creating a society where most people are not asked through the structures of life to actually engage in thinking about the larger society and what kind of society they want. I think there's more democracy, though, in social life. Feminism has made it possible for women to become citizens and to fight back, as well as the civil rights movement, of course, which triggered everything. They're the things that most people do most of the time, which is the workplace. It's become more dominated from the top, and people have much less room, especially now where everybody's afraid for their job, for people actually to think about it and to actually democratically participate in those crucial decisions.
That's an interesting description of our current condition, and I must confess I want to sit and think about this for a little bit. I want to maybe talk you through how I think about that. I certainly agree that under conditions of economic uncertainty and hardship, people are mindful of speaking up or organizing in ways that might threaten their employment. What I'd like to know, and I don't know, is how that has changed from the perspective of the individual worker, the individual employee, over time. I don't look romantically on the past in America or in the other advanced industrial economies at times when workers were involved in great moments of democratic politics that didn't involve anything other than hard work and struggle. And so I don't think that there's been a change in the conditions of employment. I don't know, I should say, if there's been a change in the conditions of employment right now. I do believe that the union movement has been greatly hobbled by regulations that limit its ability to organize in certain states, by deindustrialization, by technological change, and by other factors as well.
And by capital mobility. They just tell workforces, if you vote for a union or if you go on strike, we're out of here. That's a real threat, and everybody knows it.
Right. But again, my point is that that's not new. That's always been the argument that the employer or the boss.
Right. But now they really can't do it, and the factories are shuttered all in every Rust Belt city, so...
Right.
It's not an empty threat.
I don't think it is an empty threat. I think you can see the march of manufacturing employment from, say, upstate New York to South Carolina and Tennessee. And I think that will demonstrate that quite simply and quite powerfully. But there's more than just that at play, and I don't think this is a new development. The weight of this problem and its consequences for American labor, I think, are interesting in that I don't think that many of those who have suffered from deindustrialization and the collapse of the manufacturing sector believe that the Democratic Party has within it a plan to rescue their jobs.
Or to put them in a secure position where they can lead a life and look forward to the future and educate their kids.
I think that remains the case that the Democratic Party is going to have to make. And it also remains the case that even the Democratic Party's progressive challengers on the left will need to make as well.
Tom Papinski, thanks a lot for talking to us. But we have to talk again on the question of authoritarians capitalizing on fear and disorder. And in a lot of work, and I think yours too, you take the position that the fear and disorder is sort of personalized against other people or immigrants or the rest, and that's real, and that they've succeeded in doing that, like Trump. I wonder, though, if in fact there's a deeper cause of people's worries and anxieties, but that they can't express it because it's dangerous to think about it that way. We have to understand that their authoritarian rise based in threats to their economic well-being and the tremendous precariousness of most people now. There are no settled jobs and no settled lives nearly everywhere, including in agriculture, where industrial agriculture forcing people off the land everywhere. Anyway, why don't you just reply to that, and then we'll sign off.
I think that a classic tool of the aspiring authoritarian is to argue that there's something menacing and wrong in society, and that menacing thing can have many number of different names. It can be illegal immigrants who, quote, don't belong here, unquote, or it can be drug abusers, which is common in Southeast Asia, or homosexuals, something also common in Southeast Asia, to argue that this is some sort of latent threat that exists, or it could be sometimes argued that perhaps a religious minority or a communist movement. Whatever it is, the idea is named a threat which exists and is kind of like a cancer on society. And aspiring authoritarians make this argument on the presumption that voters will respond by saying that they are willing to sacrifice some of their liberties or some of their rights for the purpose of containing that threat. I think that the far more insidious process in the United States is not the mobilization of those in the working classes who have been dispossessed or disenfranchised or made uncertain and precarious through the change in the economy, but rather the mobilization of the middle classes around a presumed threat that is even sometimes hard for them to see, but they can fear it anyway, that there is a movement of black people or immigrants or Muslims or some other identity group within American politics that needs to just be eliminated.
Yeah, I think you're right in that, but it changes the appeals to working people, do change the voting patterns a little bit of the bottom half sufficiently to win elections. That would be my reply, but it was really good talking to you. Thanks a lot. We'll talk again.
You're welcome. Thanks for taking the time. This was fun. I appreciate it.
Right. So long.